Have you started your taxes yet, or do you like to wait until the last minute? Hi, Jill Nadeau here. I'm sitting in for Larry Mueller today. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Mary Mellum is of Wabanon Tax Professionals is back with us today. Mary and her husband, David, have been in the tax business for more than 30 years, serving individuals, consulting to tax professionals, and teaching tax seminars around the country. She always has great advice and information for us. What tax questions do you have? Join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234, or you can post on the Larry Mueller Facebook page. Mary, so glad to have you back.
Hi, Jill. It's nice to be here.
Is this a little break for you from all the taxes that you're doing?
Let's put it that way.
Okay. Well, we appreciate you taking a little time because I know how busy you are. Tuesday, April 18th is tax day this year. How concerned should people be if they don't have their taxes in or almost ready to go?
Well, April 18th is coming up, mm-hmm. and there's always extensions that can be filed if you're not ready. The danger, though, is if you owe money in, the extension does not give you an extension of time to pay.
Okay.
So it's important that if they're not ready to file, that they plan for any payment that they may have to do and file that extension and send the money in with it.
Okay. And then how close do they have to be? I mean, because obviously if they knew exactly what they owed, they'd have their taxes done, right?
Well, it's a good estimate. Uh-huh. It's good because what you don't pay, there is a failure to file penalty, which is satisfied by filing the extension temporarily, as long as they do it before the extension is invalid.
Okay.
But there is a failure to pay penalty, which is 0.5% per month until it's paid.
Ooh, and that can add up, can it?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And there's a failure to file penalty, which is 5% per month. So that failure to file penalty is a big number.
Yes.
It can exceed 25%, but if you file the extension, you don't have that penalty. You just have the 0.5%, then plus the interest on the money. So,
and that's a pretty easy form to fill out, too, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay.
The extension form doesn't ask for a whole lot. It doesn't even ask for your signature anymore.
Oh.
So it is. It's something that, if they're not ready, that is an alternative.
Okay. Well, that's something definitely to think about if you've got a pretty complicated tax return. Now, speaking of complicated tax returns, I know you had kind of sent me some situations that you may have run across when you've been doing taxes, but they're kind of unusual. And one of them that kind of caught my eye was the person who was having a wedding and invited business associates. So what can you tell us about that situation?
Well, taxpayers are always looking for
yes,
a way
are.
To cut their taxes. And
sure.
There are legitimate ways to cut their taxes, and there are expenses that are not allowed. This particular person, and it was a court case some years ago, was a business person. And, of course, we know with business people that when you take your clients out to dinner or out entertain your clients, that you are allowed a business deduction for that entertainment cost as long as there is a business meeting connected before, after, or during the meal, and there is a presumption that this will lead to increased revenue. So this particular person decided that it was good for his business for his clients to be invited to the wedding and tried to write it off. And, of course, the IRS and the tax court said, no, it's a personal event, that it's a non-deductible expense.
A for imagination, but no
yes.
go.
Okay. Yes. So all of you that are having weddings, don't try this.
Sorry.
It doesn't work.
Yeah, not going to work. Okay. Well, Mary, our phone lines are filled right now, so let's go right to those. Lisa and Madison, what's your question for Mary?
Well, I have two business questions, but I just thought of one. My son is on disability, Social Security disability, and has had no earned income. Does he need to file?
No, he does not, as long as he has no income, not necessarily earned income, but dividends and things like that. But if he does not have that kind of income, his disability alone will not require him to file a tax return.
Okay, great. Okay, now, I had a small collectible store. Ending inventory at 2015 was $1,000, so my beginning inventory for this year, or for 16, will be $1,000. I had sales of $200, which was the cost of goods sold, so minus that from the $1,000 leaves an ending inventory for 2016 of $800. Since I closed the business mid-year, what do I do with that $800 of ending inventory?
That $800 of ending inventory stays with that inventory. If you are going to sell the inventory later, that is part of your cost in the inventory that you have to reflect. If prior to the closing of the business or upon closing of the business, you threw it away, that would be getting that down to zero in your ending inventory would be zero, and you would have been able to take the loss for it if you had disposed of the product. If it's sitting on your shelf, then it's yours and the $800 stays with it until you do something with it.
Okay, does that answer your question, Lisa?
Is there a place where this is shown, or is it just something I keep in the back of my mind till something happens with it? Or, I mean, let's say I disposed of it.
That's exactly right. If you disposed of it and got anything for it, you would be able, you would compare what you got for the articles to the $800, and you'd have gain or loss. Your business is kind of going on, in a sense, in the background. Even though you've closed the business, that inventory is still business property, and what you do with it will be reflected in that way.
All right. So let's say I disposed of it. Where on the form do I put that I disposed of it?
If you disposed of it before or after the business?
As the business ended.
As the business ended, your ending inventory would go to zero, and the $800 would come through as a cost of goods sold.
I would just add that to the $200 of cost of goods sold.
No, because yes. It would add to the $200 of cost of goods sold, and you'd have a loss on your Schedule C.
All right. Okay. That's why I was wondering, where do I put this number? My second question is, I have this property that I inherited in 2000, and it was a tavern. I did some improvements to it, a roof, and put in a new cooler and wiring, blah, blah, blah. I've been taking the depreciation when I ran the business. Since 2007, I rented it and was taking the depreciation on the Schedule E. Now, I sold the whole property. It includes the tavern and this little store and a house and so on in July, end of July. So does the depreciation, is it prorated? That I take, you know, part of the year?
Depreciation on real property is on a monthly basis. And so for every month that it was depreciated, you would get that much of the depreciation.
And is there a form where it allows me to do that?
It's a calculation that's done underneath. There isn't a formula. I mean, there isn't a form that will do it for you. It will show up on your 4562 where you've taken the depreciation in prior years.
All right. Now, I use, not to promote a product here, but I use TurboTax. Will they walk me through that?
I have no idea. I do not use TurboTax, so I have no idea how that program works. But it is an allocation. You're not allowed the full depreciation. You're not prohibited from taking any in that year, but the calculation is there. I would suggest with the situation that you have here, I would suggest that you seek professional guidance with this.
Okay, great. Well, thank you, Lisa. Appreciate the call. Let's go over to Robert. He's also in Madison. Hi, Robert. What's up with you?
Hi. I was in grad school for a good 10 years, and then finally got a job in February. in a very big organization, and there was some mix-up, and they didn't take any taxes out for the entire year. Okay. And I owe about $4,000 that I don't have, and I'm just curious if there's any, you have any suggestions.
IRS is more than happy to set up installment agreements, and the IRS will allow you to pay that money over time. Right now, the current rate of interest is 4%, and as I mentioned on an earlier call, there is a failure to pay penalty of 0.5% per month. But if you set up an installment agreement, there is a way to reduce that penalty to 0.25% per month. The best thing to do is contact the IRS and let them know your situation, and they will walk you through it.
Okay, well, good luck with that, Robert. I can relate because the same thing happened to me. So good luck with that. Let's go to Jason in Appleton. Hi, Jason.
Hello. Hey, just a quick question. Last August, I started helping a friend who was designing and building a website. So I just started doing, and I still am doing a lot of work from home. It's just been kind of like a part-time gig. I think maybe I'll end up claiming, maybe $1,200 in taxes from 2016 that he paid me, because he just paid me cash. So obviously I'm claiming that income on my taxes coming up. I'm wondering, prior to me starting working for him, I bought a new computer, and I'm wondering if there's any sort of deduction or any way I could claim anything with that computer, that I'm using it to earn this income, if there's anything I can do with that computer.
Business assets, Jason, are depreciable assets, and so that asset could be depreciated for the year. If you bought it and placed it in service in the same year, it's possible you may be able to write the entire amount off. However, because I'm assuming that computer is part personal and part business,
correct,
that you have to come up with an allocation of how much business use versus how much personal use. And certainly you can depreciate the business use. Special rules for expensing may be prohibited depending on how much personal versus business use. But there is an ability to write it off. I don't know what else you do with website development, but perhaps internet use, some of those other expenses, if there's any office supplies and things, you might be able to write those things off depending on what you spent against that income.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Mary. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. I'm sitting in for Larry today on the Ideas Network. We've been talking with Mary Mellum. She is a tax professional who has been in the tax business for more than 30 years. Mary and her husband, David, operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals and are enrolled agents. Do you have a question for her? Give us a call. Our lines are full right now, but you can hopefully get through on email, and that's ideas@wpr.org. Coming up at 1 o'clock today, Kathleen Dunn will be speaking to a national security reporter who will break down the FBI director's first public comments about Russian meddling, ongoing investigations, and President Donald Trump's wiretap claims. That's at 1 o'clock today on the Ideas Network. Right now, we're talking about taxes, and let's go right back to the phones because we have a full house. Arlene in Arlington, what's your question for Mary?
Hello, Mary. In my studies, I have just learned that there's a new law that says if you wrote a check to a charitable organization for more than $250, now the canceled check is no longer your proof. You now have to have a letter from each of them. Is that retroactive? Is that for 2016 also, or is it start in 17?
That law took effect probably back in 2010. So it's not a new law. It's been on the books for several years. What the IRS says is that you must have receipts for all of your charitable donations, no matter how big or small. Canceled checks still work for anything that is written for less than $250 to an organization. That is not anything new this year. Also, if it is $250 or more than $250, you need to have a letter from the organization in your hand when you file your tax return that says, thank you very much for your donation. By the way, no goods and services were provided for this gift. Or if, as in the case of sometimes, I believe, public TV, when you donate to the public TV and you receive a video, a DVD, the cost of that has to be subtracted from your donation. And public TV does a good job of sending out those receipts showing that. But once again, this is not anything new. I believe about 2010 was when this took effect.
Okay, great. Thanks for the question, Arlene. I'm sure everyone benefited from that one. Let's go to Catherine in Random Lake. Hi, Catherine.
Hello. Hi, Mary. I've already had my taxes done this year. I was 70 years old in 2016, and I was under the impression that once I turned, for me, 67 years old, or actually, I suppose 68, that I could make as much as I want, and that wasn't dunned off my Social Security. When I had my taxes done this year, for every $2 over $25,000, I was dunned a dollar off my Social Security, and I owe $1,467.
Okay, Catherine, I think there's two concepts that are kind of getting mixed up here. There is the concept of having to give back Social Security when you earn too much money prior to a certain age. And the other is the taxability of Social Security itself. The giving back of Social Security because you earn too much, at your full retirement age, which full retirement age used to be 65, and now it is dependent upon your age, but somewhere around 66 and a few months. And I don't have the chart in front of me exactly. But when a person reaches full retirement age, after that point, they can make as much earned income as they want without having to give any of that Social Security back to the government. That's the $2, $1 for every $2 you earn over that. And that's what you're talking about with that. On the tax return, however, at any age that you're receiving Social Security, if your earnings, depending on being a single person, your income, depending on being a single person or a married person, there is a certain income level that says those Social Security benefits you receive must be included in income. And for a single person, it's $25,000, and I believe the next level is $32,000. And for a married person, there is a $35,000 and $42,000 level that says at some point you get 50% of your Social Security is added in as if it were income, like a wage or something. It can go up to a maximum of 85%. So I'm not sure if it's something you're seeing on the tax return, then it's because your other income is large enough to make the Social Security become a taxable event. It has nothing to do with earnings. At your age, you should not be giving back to the Social Security system any of your earnings because you worked.
I shouldn't.
Not if it's if Social Security is coming back to you on their pink slip that you get at the end of the year and says, we're charging you and taking away from your benefits a certain amount, then there's something wrong with the age that they see you at or something. But if it's something that you're seeing on your tax return, it's not because of your earnings. It is because of your overall income that is causing it to be taxable.
So basically they're telling me that all I'm worth is $25,000 a year, and if I make more than that, I'm, rolling in money or something?
No. I think when you looked at your tax return completed on the Social Security line, did you see a part of your Social Security benefits that showed up there?
What line is that? I've got it in front of me. I have to admit I don't know what line that is.
I'll have to look at the tax return and tell you.
I don't know.
It's probably about line 20. But you should ask your tax professional to explain the Social Security taxability situation to you so that you can see how it affects you. The taxable Social Security line is line 20B.
So 20B has me at $14,270.
That has nothing to do with you working. That has to do with the fact that you are making enough money overall in your income that it is causing part of your Social Security benefits to be taxable. So it's not the two-for-one give-back. It's just the normal tax law that requires some people to pay taxes on their Social Security benefits. No more than 85% of the benefit will ever show up on that line.
Okay, well, great. Thank you, Mary, for that information. And Catherine, thank you for your question. We've got an email that we would like to look at right now from Dwayne. He asked if there is any way to get the IRS to forgive a loss on a home that he bought. The bank forgave the $40,000 loss, but the IRS sees it as income. He is also asking how to make those payments to the IRS.
Okay. What Dwayne is talking about is a cancellation of debt. It's a 1099-C form that is received when you have, when an institution has said, we either no longer can collect this debt or we agree to forgive you and not make you responsible. The IRS looks at that as income. There is a code section 108 that is dealing with debt cancellation, and it basically says it's taxable unless you can meet one of the exceptions. There are a series of four or five exceptions. One of them is insolvency. One is qualified real property business indebtedness. One is qualified farm indebtedness. And another is your principal residence indebtedness. It sounds like that one might apply to him, and if the debt was to buy, build, or substantially renovate his principal residence, it is possible that he could exclude that debt. There is a Form 982 that needs to be filled out to prove this or to tell the government this. If he doesn't meet that situation, then installment, as I mentioned before, the IRS will set up installment agreements that you can do just by contacting the IRS. And I say contacting them because there is a 9465 form that you can fill out and send in, but that's not the best way to get the least cost method because they do charge for their services, and sending that in will cause them to have a fee that they may be able to get out of by contacting the IRS.
So basically they just call an 800 number and...
They call an 800 number. If they go to the IRS website and type in installment agreements, they'll find lots of information and I'm sure a phone number there to contact them.
Do you think in his case that Dwayne may want to contact a professional to help him out with this?
Anytime a person gets a 1099 A or a 1099-C. A is the abandonment of property, the bank taking it back, for instance, and a C, the cancellation. It's an excellent time to get professional help.
Okay, thank you. We're talking today with Mary Mellum. She's a tax professional who's been in the tax business for more than 30 years. What questions do you have about your taxes? We have a couple phone lines that are open, so give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. And you can also send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Let's go back to Rob in La Crosse. Hi, Rob. What's your question for Mary?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So this isn't a complaint because it might sound like it, but my wife and I are very fortunate. We both have good jobs and we make good money. And 3 years ago, we actually had to pay in. We both claimed zero. And then our son was born 2 years ago. So we had that for a deduction. We don't get very much back, which is fine. But I take home about 55% of my paycheck after deductions right now. A lot of that is retirement and stuff. I was just wondering what you could recommend for more deductions or better deductions to help with, I guess, the tax bracket that we're in.
Okay. One of the first things that I ask my clients is, are you taking advantage of things at work? And those are things like 401k, which it sounds like you probably are taking advantage of that, 401k, 403b, simple, those kinds of things. And that's number one on the list. Number two, if you have opportunities for HSA plans or flex spending accounts or dependent care benefits, those are also ways that you can reduce your income and take advantage of those programs. If you've used up all of those things, depending on where your income level is, there's ways to put money into IRAs that may also help it. And then after that, again, if you've taken advantage of all of those things and you're doing any investing, the places where you put your investments not to create income on the tax return may be another thing to look at.
Okay. Well, thank you, Rob. Hopefully you can take advantage of that. Let's go to John in Glendale. Hi, John. What's your question?
Oh, hi. I'm going to try not to get tongue-tied. I turned 70 in March, and I'm just going to have to start taking my required minimum distribution. And what I'm concerned about is, I was listening to another financial advisor earlier today on WPR, and he said something about if I don't sign up by 4/1, that I could lose half my half the money that's distributed to taxes. I don't know if he meant 4/1 of 17 or 18, because I won't be 70 and a half, you know, till later in the year.
Okay, John, what he's talking about is that the law says that you must start taking your distribution by April 1st of the year following the year you turn 70 and a half. So if you turn 70 in March, you will turn 70 and a half in September, and that means that you have until April 1st of 2018 to get the money out for the year 2017. And I say that because that April 1st is kind of a grace period that gives you an extra, basically, 3 months beyond the year that you turn 70 to get that money out. But if you don't get it out by that time, the 50% is an excise tax that the government says we get to keep half of what you should have taken out if you don't take it out on time. So nobody wants to miss that deadline. But what you should really think about is, in the year you turn 70 and a half, take out your distribution for that year by the end of the year. Forget about the grace period. It's just a little Band-Aid. Because the next year, when you're 71, you will also have to take a distribution. If you use that extra 3 months, you will have to take out two distributions in the year that you turn 71. So take one out in 17 for the age 70 and a half. Take one out in 18, and then you'll be good. Don't worry about that April 1st. Just get it done within the year, and you won't have problems with it.
Okay, well, thank you very much, John, for that call. We appreciate that. Let's go to Maureen in La Crosse. Hi, Maureen. What can we help you with today?
I drive my own vehicle to work or between jobs for work, and my employer reimburses at 31 cents a mile for the miles I put on, and it's tracked on GPS, so I have a good record of it. Is there a better rate is there a way to do taxes where I can get more than 31 cents a mile?
If you are an employee, the answer is yes, there's a better rate. For 2016, the standard mileage rate is 54 cents a mile. In 2017, it drops to 53.5 cents a mile. But you need to first be able to itemize your deductions. And within itemizing, as an employee, there is a Form 2106 that you would need to fill out to capture the difference between the 54 and the 31.
Okay, I'm part-time, so I guess I can't itemize. So that
Don't otherwise itemize because you have a home and because you pay property taxes or have charitable contributions, then it's not going to make any difference to you. You have to first be able to itemize, and then within itemizing, taking employee business expenses on Form 2106.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I do pay property tax, and I do contributions or donations, but I'm not sure it's enough to.
If you're a single person, that magic number that you have to get over is 6,300. If you're married, it's 12,600. And if you're over 65, there is an additional amount that goes on to that. So it depends on where you fall in. The law does allow you to take it. It just doesn't necessarily mean it will help your particular situation.
Okay. Well, good luck, Maureen. Thank you for the call. Kent in Reedstown called to ask if he can write off half the cost of building his house if he rents out the houses downstairs.
The way that that's presented is interesting, because if I were taking it just in the surface of what that is, I would say no to that question. But what he's really asking is that if part of my property is a rental property, can I depreciate the rental property? And the answer is yes. If it is 50-50 rental personal, the rental portion is allowed depreciation, which is a way of getting a deduction for the cost of that property.
Okay, there you go, Kent. That's good news.
Keep in mind, though, anytime you depreciate property, when you sell that property, you will, in essence, pay that back because your basis is lowered by that. So depreciation is just kind of putting things off.
Okay. Well, let's go back to the phones. And we do have a phone line open if anybody wants to give it a try. The number is 1-800-642-1234. And let's go to April in Oak Creek. Hi, April. What question do you have?
Hi. I have a question. My husband ended up owing taxes a couple of years ago, and we didn't have enough money at the time, and we were trying to make payments. However, during that time, we were also under bankruptcy. We tried contacting the IRS to figure out how much we owed left, how much we were supposed to owe. What we got from them was because under bankruptcy, they couldn't come after us, which we understand, but they also said there was going to be interest added on. Now bankruptcy is over. It was over this year, Chapter 13, and I know we still owe. We would like to know what we'd like to pay what we owe, but we don't really know how much it is, and we haven't gotten anything from them.
You're lucky you haven't gotten anything from them. They're usually pretty good about sending letters, but you can contact the IRS, and I know that that's sometimes a difficult feat to do, but you can contact them, and they can give you an account up to date of what is owed on it. Bankruptcy is a strange situation in the sense that we file bankruptcy and put the debts in it, and the debts are forgiven. IRS says that if you owed taxes, they will forgive taxes in bankruptcy, but they have to be a certain age that they are before they can be forgiven. So during the period of bankruptcy, IRS can't take any property for those things, but after the bankruptcy, if those debts weren't forgiven in bankruptcy, they can still get after them. I encourage you to contact them and ask them for an account history of what you owe and for what years.
Okay, should we contact the IRS? We are doing our taxes actually this Friday. Should we try to contact them before we do our taxes again for this year?
Your taxes for this year should not. Was the bankruptcy in 2016?
No, we filed in like 2011. It was like a.
So the bankruptcy would have been, if the bankruptcy forgave any debts for tax debts, they would have been old ones. So what you're doing now should have no bearing on that. The only thing that I would caution you as you're filing this year's tax return, if you do owe the IRS or the state any money, it's a possibility that any refund that you have may be taken to pay those debts. And usually they'll send you a notice after the fact saying you didn't get your money because we took it to satisfy.
They're good at that, right? They keep track of that pretty well. Mary, you know, kind of on that same track, I've noticed commercials on TV that say, you know, I owed $20,000 to the IRS. I called this number and now I owe $5,000. What is that all about?
Good advertising.
Okay.
IRS does, I hate to use this term, make deals, but IRS has a program called Offer and Compromise. And with properly filled out forms and proper situations, the IRS can reduce people's debts that they owe. But it's not as easy as they show on TV.
Okay.
And if you logically think about it, advertising is expensive. And if you advertise, you've got to be able to bring in enough revenue to pay for that advertising. If anyone has a situation where they owe money and they think they're a candidate for the offer and compromise, they should seek someone who is able to represent them before the IRS. And that is a person who is an enrolled agent, a certified public accountant, or an attorney. All have the power to represent people before the IRS. And so that's where they should go first.
Okay.
I would suggest local, where you can talk to someone rather than the late night TV thing.
I thought you were going to say that. I kind of thought the same thing. It sounded too good to be true. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau, sitting in for Larry today on the Ideas Network. We're talking with Mary Mellum. She is a tax professional who has been in the tax business for more than 30 years. Mary and her husband, David, operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals and are enrolled agents. Do you have a question for her? Give us a call. Number is 1-800-642-1234. So tomorrow at 11, we're going to be talking about Wisconsin lakes and how we can keep them healthy. Hope you can join us. Right now, we're talking about taxes, and we're going to go right back to the phones and talk to Karen in Eau Claire. Hi, Karen. What's going on with you?
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. My question is having to do with my mother's passing away. I'm the executor of her estate, which is, you know, small, $50,000 or less. And I wonder if I need to be responsible for filing a final tax return. Her only income was Social Security. And then just before she passed, she sold a small amount of stock, which she had inherited, so it's, you know, totally taxable, $500, though. So there is income, and then there's Social Security.
Karen, under the numbers that you described, she wouldn't have a filing requirement. And when you say the stock that she sold, it was $500 for the sale, or the profit was $500?
Profit was five.
How much was the total stock that was sold?
About $500.
Okay. So that's what you got for selling the stock.
And that's about, it was worth about that when she inherited it. Okay. So the capital gains is minimal.
There is no requirement to file a tax return. The only reason that you may want to file a tax return is just kind of to put everything to an end and report the sale, report the date of death, and say basically this is a final return. It's not a requirement. It's just something I like to do just to kind of let the IRS know that this is the last return you're going to get in this Social Security number. But it is not a requirement. It's just a personal preference on my part.
Okay, great. Thanks for that call, Karen. Let's go to Adel in Mozamani. Hi, Adel. Did I pronounce your name right?
Adel is right, but Mozamani.
Okay.
My question is, my daughter is getting married this year. And last year in August, she and her fiancé bought a house jointly. So my question for Mary is, who should, when they file for last year, who should claim the house? The one that's making the more money or the one that's making the less money?
That's a good question, Adele, and it really doesn't have anything to do with who's making the money. It's who paid the mortgage interest and property taxes.
I see. Okay.
Now, if you're daughter and prospective son-in-law have a joint account that they pay the money out of, they should split it and each one put it on evenly on their tax return.
Okay, that makes sense. All right, can I ask one other quick question? When my wife and I filed our returns, we owed the state of Wisconsin some, $200 or $300. But our tax preparer said you have to send the money to the state to this address, which is different. That's what's in the book as far as the instructions for corresponding with the state of Wisconsin Department of Revenue. You know anything about that?
If it is an electronically filed return, there is a certain post, there is a certain box number for an electronically filed return, and that is a Milwaukee post office box, 930208,
okay,
if it's electronically filed. On
all
the
right
bottom of the forms, you might see different numbers that are for paper filed returns.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank
You're
you,
welcome.
Adele. All right, let's go to Lewis in La Crosse. Hi, Lewis.
Good morning. This question concerns the earned income tax credit, specifically for filers who wouldn't have to normally file for their taxes because they don't have enough income, but yet, according to a couple of news reports lately, are encouraged to go ahead and file anyway because they may be eligible for that income tax credit. And I was wondering, is there a sort of a ballpark bottom line minimum amount you would need to get, say, for Social Security or something like that to make it worthwhile filing the taxes for that earned income?
Okay. First of all, earned income credit is generally given to people who have worked, have a W-2 or a Schedule C or a Schedule F income that Social Security or basically Social Security or the form of it, self-employment tax, are paid on. And generally, earned income credit benefits those who have children. And so as long as there is a W-2 and one or more children, there is the possibility of getting this free money by filing a tax return. There is also an ability for people who have low income that have earnings and are under age 65 that they can get it also for having no children. That one is a maximum around $12,000 to $13,000 for the single person. For the family or for the single parent who has children, the earned income credit is given based on the number of children you have, and the income that you can earn as a married couple with three children is something like $48,000. So it's definitely something to look into, but you have to have earned income, W-2 or 1099 income, in order to qualify.
Okay. Well, thank you, Lewis, for that question. Next up is Beverly in La Crosse. Hi, Beverly. What can we do for you?
Hi. I have a small business, and I do. I typically every year deduct a portion of the house for my business. Now, this past year, I had contractors in doing extensive repairs and maintenance and so forth. Do I need to send the contractors 1099s?
If you have paid the contractors $600 or more in the course of your trade or business, in other words, if this is going to benefit your business, then yes, you need to do that, and you needed to do that by January 31st. Of this year, because there are penalties for not having filed them with the contractors and filed them with the government. And the penalty, I believe, is $260 for not sending it to the contractor and $260 for not sending it to the IRS timely per 1099 that you should have sent.
Okay, I called an accountant here in La Crosse and asked him about this. And he told me, no, he didn't believe I needed to do it. So what part of the IRS code can I look this up under so I know that this qualifies as a necessary 1099?
I can't give you the code section off the top of my head for that one. Go to the IRS website and look up filing 1099s. If the individual was talking to you about personal individuals, on a personal basis, you wouldn't have to file 1099s. It's only because it is in the course of your trade or business. That would be the only reason that you would do it. But go to the IRS website, type in 1099 requirements, and you'll find it there.
Okay, good luck with that, Beverly. Let's go to Peggy in Darlington. Hi, Peggy.
Hi.
What's your question?
Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, what's your question?
I have a question regarding paying tax on an inheritance that was not in a tax-deferred account. I think that you pay taxes only on the earnings, but I wanted to be sure.
Can you describe more of what this inheritance was?
The inheritance was invested in stocks and bonds and the sale of a residence.
Okay. And when you inherit stocks or bonds, the stock or the bond that you inherit is not a taxable event. It is the earnings that from the time of death until you receive that property that becomes the taxable portion of it.
Okay, so when you receive it, you pay taxes only on the earnings after receiving it.
Generally, yes. Let me give you an example. You have General Motors stock, and if Mom bought the General Motors stock long time ago, Mom died, and the stock today is worth, and I'm just picking out a number, not necessarily reality, but we'll say that it's worth $100 on the day that she died. Your basis in that stock is $100. But if Mom had an estate and before that stock was given to you, the estate received $10 of dividends on that stock, that $10 of dividends received after Mom died, but before you became the actual owner of the stock, will be taxable to you through the estate.
So would the estate do that filing, or would I do that filing?
If if there is an estate tax return due, a Form 1041, it is due if there is gross income from the estate of $600 or more, or any taxable income. There would have to be something done with it that would be passed out to you via a K-1 form. If there's none of that going on and you're the sole heir and the sole heir to this and you get the stock, you're also going to pay taxes on any dividends that were paid after she died. And there wouldn't be anything other than you're going to get the 1099 saying that that's taxable.
Okay, hopefully that answered all your questions there, Peggy. We've been talking with Mary Mellum. She is a tax professional who's been in the tax business for more than 30 years. Mary and her husband, David, operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals and are enrolled agents. And we're going to be back after the news to talk a lot more about taxes, hopefully answer yours. If you have questions for us, you can call 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll be right back after the news. Are you getting a little anxious about filing your taxes? Hi, I'm Jill Nadeau, and I'm filling in for Larry Mueller today. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Our tax expert is back with us to help make filing a little less painful. Mary Mellum has been in the tax business for more than 30 years, and she and her husband David operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals, and they consult to individuals and businesses and also teach seminars. What questions do you have? You can try giving us a call, though right now all of our lines are busy, but the number is 800-642-1234, and you can send us an email, and that's ideas@wpr.org. And let's go right back to the phones, because I know there's a lot of people waiting to hear your advice, Mary. Let's go to Gail in Fish Creek. Hi, Gail.
Hi. I'm calling with a concern that I put at your guest, who sounds really, really knowledgeable and helping a lot of people. I know that there's a bill that was passed that gives approval for money management firms to buy up forgiven debt and then go after those people for the money. And I'm wondering if there's anything that people are doing legally in order to not become victim of that, because I know that that's out there.
Mary, do you have any idea?
I do not know of anything like of this particular bill. I know that if you're in business and you have people that owe you money, there are businesses that will buy those accounts receivable so that the business person recovers something, and then they can go out, they can go after that. That's not a whole lot different than companies turning it over to a credit agency. If there are people that are living on the edge, so to speak, and doing things improperly, then certainly they should be reported to the government or the Better Business Bureau or something like that. But I'm not familiar with any particular bill.
Okay, Gail, you might want to consider contacting the Consumer Protection Agency. If they can't help you, I'm sure they'll know who can. So hopefully you'll be able to get a good...
Hello?
Yes, Gail?
It hasn't happened to me. It has happened to other people, and that's the concern, that these people were under the assumption that they were forgiven their debts, and then they had collection agencies going after them, and it was for personal debt. It wasn't anything to do with business. So that's what was really concerning, and that became a real issue in the news last year. And then there was a bill that was passed, and that was the problem.
Okay. I would, again, just call Consumer Protection. And you know, we have those people from that area on the first Thursday of every month. So if you want to call back then and ask them that question or just give them a call, you can easily find them on the Internet. So hopefully you'll be able to figure out what's going on with that. Let's go now to Rod in Madison. Hi, Rod. What's your question?
Thank you for taking my call. My question is related to the earlier gentleman about higher income bracket. I have done, my wife and I, all the things that you mentioned, the HSA, with the employer. And I have two questions. One, in terms of strategy, I was told something like trust fund gifts or a business on the side that would help reduce the tax obligation. My other specific question related to that, if I start a business on the side and I have losses, especially in starting it, I dump money in it from my own income, can that negative amount be reducing my earned income from my salary? So I will stop and listen. Thank you for taking my
time. Sure. It's a very good question, and a lot of people with higher incomes are looking for ways to save tax dollars. Starting a business certainly is a way to do it, but keep in mind, and in starting a business, traditionally, businesses as they start with negatives, and those negatives created by a business, if you're involved in the business, can reduce your income. But also keep in mind that if you are truly starting a business, your purpose in starting a business is eventually to make money. And so if a business is started just as a way to have negatives to reduce income, the IRS gets a little concerned about that and labels those kinds of things as tax shelters. And tax shelters are not very favorable when there isn't a real consciousness to make a profit. So, yes, in the startup years of a business, the losses do reduce your other income. And as long as it's legitimate, there's no problem with that. Also, rental properties are things that can legitimately have losses. Usually the losses are the depreciation that you take, and IRS doesn't get so excited about that because when you sell the property, they're going to get their money back there. So having rental property is a way to have a negative on the tax return that is an acceptable negative, but there are some other conditions. Too high of income will not allow you to have that negative. They start phasing out this passive activity at $100,000. At $150,000 AGI or modified AGI, it's gone. So those things are kind of put on the shelf for later. But there's certainly things that can be done to relieve some of it.
Okay. All right, Rod, thank you for the call. Excuse me. Let's go to Jan in Viroqua. Hi, Jan. What's your question?
Good morning, Mary. Good morning. My question has to do with student loans. I hold a student loan that began as a large loan, and I'm in an income-based repayment plan over the course of 20-25 years where I'm not. My assessed payment based on that plan is less than the interest that's accruing. And so what's going to happen is if they forgive that loan in about 15 more years, I am going to have a loan forgiveness that even if it's spread out over 3 years, each of those 3 years will far exceed the total income I've earned in any year in my life. And so I'm wondering whether I have to start saving and replanning my life around that or what options there might be.
One of the things with the student loans, if at some point there is debt forgiveness, as I mentioned before when we were talking earlier about debt cancellation. As a reporting form, you would receive a 1099-C saying that this amount is taxable as debt cancellation. If your situation is as you say, looking at the debt the minute before it's forgiven, if you are insolvent, in other words, if the debt is bigger than all of the assets that you own compared to that debt, you would not have to pay taxes on that debt. So I guess I would suggest that you look at whether insolvency meets your situation, in other words, all your accumulated property compared to that debt, And if your assets are greater than that, then I guess starting to save to pay those taxes that will come is an important thing.
Okay, well, good luck with that, Jan. And we're going to go to Chuck now in Appleton. Hi, Chuck.
Hi. The question I have is, I've went to itemized deductions every other year, and so this year I'm itemizing, and so on Schedule A, we sort of cleaned the house and got rid of a lot of items, and so I made a donation to Goodwill, but it ended up being more than the last donation I made there was like for $300. And I see where if you have over 250 for some item, you need to, and this was a number of items. So do I have to file another form other than that form 8283? If on December 29th, donated all these items and it totaled up to be more than the 250?
The 250 that was mentioned earlier is talking about cash or money donations. Your used goods donations come under a different rule. And the rule there is if it is over $500 or more, there is another form that you will file, and it's an 8283 form that tells what organization that you gave it to, what the fair market value of the items that you're giving, and that nature. And as long as what you've given to them, to the organizations collectively, is not over $5,000, there isn't an appraisal needed. You need to have a slip from Goodwill, St. Vincent's, whatever the organization is, and you should have a list compiled of all of the things that you've donated to them. I suggest that you go one step further, and as you're packing the vehicle to take it to that organization, that you pull out your smartphone and use it as a camera and take a picture, not of every single item, but the items collectively. Because in this situation, IRS also has the power to say, to challenge the amount that you have put on these items, because there is no set dollar. And so if you have a picture, you're establishing the quality of the items, as opposed to saying, IRS is saying, you really should have thrown them in the trash rather than giving them away and assessing a dollar amount. So the $250 doesn't belong in this particular situation.
Okay.
I'm asking that is under Schedule A on line 17, it talks about other than by cash or check. If any gift of $250 or more, see instructions. And I do understand about having to file the form, the 8283 form, but it so happens on December 29th, all the items I brought in, because we, like I said, clean closets and so on, ended up, and again, I just used what Goodwill gave as their recommended guide for determining values. It ended up becoming, like I said, almost like 300. So you're saying I don't really, even though I would, over the course of the year, the contributions that I, those non-cash contributions ended up being the total of all of them, because there's like four organizations, that's more than 500. So I file that form 8283, but because the one contribution ended up being more than 250, it wasn't a single item, but a collection of items, you're saying I don't need to file any other form, and I can just, so if I were to be audited, and I said, okay, here's my list.
If you're audited for goods, you better have a certificate or the form from Goodwill or wherever you took those things to say that you were there and brought them in, because those organizations do not assess a value on it. But they will give you a receipt saying that you brought in certain items. If you don't have that receipt, you don't have a prayer in an audit.
Okay. All right, Chuck. Good luck with that. Thanks for that great advice, Mary. Let's go to George in Milwaukee. Hi, George. What's your question for us?
I have two questions. First one, I think, is a simple one. I retired from the military last year, and I get military retirement pay and VA disability pay, and I'm wondering if that counts towards earned income credit.
It does not.
Well, that's good to know.
Military retirement comes out on a 1099-R. It's not earned income. And your VA disability, I don't believe you even get a form for tax purposes for that because it's non-taxable.
Yeah, I don't think I can do anything about it this last year because I worked more than half a year, but next year. Second question I have, though, is also when I got out of the military, I bought a piece of property to build a home on, and I used money from a Roth IRA for that, and it's a little hard for me to understand what part of that gets penalized and taxed and what part doesn't and where I would find that information.
First of all, information on Roth IRAs, the IRS does have publications at the IRS website that deal with IRAs in general, which include Roth IRAs. Roth IRAs, I assume that to buy this property, you cashed in your Roth IRA.
A portion of it, yes.
Okay. Roth IRAs are funded with after-tax dollars. So any of the money that you have put into this Roth as a contribution, you can take that money out up to the amount that you have put into it without tax or penalty. You're just getting your own money back. If you dip into the earnings, then you're having to pay taxes on only the earnings above that. The difficulty becomes if you have rolled over something else, a pension or a traditional IRA into the Roth, there is a time period that could cost you additional penalties that apply in that situation. But I would, again, go to the IRS website at their publications. The number 560 comes to my mind, but I'm not positive. Just type in Roth IRA and you'll get the information that the IRS has available.
Okay, well, thank you for your question, George, and thank you for your service. Let's go to Al in Eau Claire. Hi, Al. What's your question?
Yes, I recently got divorced last year, and I have a substantial amount of attorney fees, and I am self-employed. I'm wondering if the attorney fees, the percentage, can be deductible, being I'm trying to save my businesses as well. And the other question would be if there's alimony paid out, is that deductible, or does she have to claim that as well as income? And that's all the questions I got.
Okay. The divorce situation creates a problem, and I'm going to do the alimony first because that probably is more black and white. If you are paying alimony, you are able to deduct the alimony as an adjustment to income. You'll need your ex-wife or ex-spouse's social security number for the document. That person would, in exchange, pick up that as income on their tax return. But it truly has to be alimony in order for that to be the case. If there is any child support in that number, then that part of it is not a deductible expense. The second part of it is attorney fees. Attorney fees for personal items are not a deductible expense. Attorney fees to collect taxable income. In other words, if your ex-spouse decided that what you were paying in alimony is not good enough and that spouse returns to the courts and sues you for additional alimony, that would be to collect taxable income, and those attorney fees would be deductible. Yours to defend your suit would not be. And as far as business, the only way that I would see any business relationship is if the attorney were only addressing something to do with the business as a result of this, and they clearly put that business relationship on their billing. That would be the only way that I would see that that would be a deductible expense, and I think that's probably a stretch.
Okay, thank you for the question, Al. We got an email that came in from Barb in Sister Bay. She loaned her son money, and he's writing off the interest on his taxes. She's wondering what kind of documentation she needs to add it to her taxes.
If she lent her son money and her son is paying her interest, her Schedule B should include her son's name, his Social Security number, and the amount of interest that he's paying her. Correspondingly, if the interest is a deductible expense on the son's return, such as she lent him money to buy his home and she holds the mortgage on the home, then he would report her name and her Social Security number as well as the amount of interest paid.
Okay, so that seems relatively easy for them to take care of that. Mary, we've only got about a half a minute before we have to go, but I was wondering, you know, if you have any last-minute tax filling out advice for people who are listening and hasn't quite got theirs done yet?
I guess my last-minute advice would be to get the things together and get it finished before the 15th. Don't wait. And if you can't, file an extension. Even if you have a refund coming, file the extension and let the IRS know that you're alive, basically. Don't wait.
And make sure you let them know, call them. It's not that difficult to get a hold of people anymore, right, in the IRS?
Well, that's another story. Have patience when you call the IRS. Sometimes it's difficult to get in. But for all of those callers that needed to call the IRS, take the time to do it. It's worth it.
Okay. And actually, we just have a little bit longer than I thought we did. But I was going to ask you, you were talking about a situation where someone who has helped out a family member financially, is there any circumstances where they can actually claim that person as a dependent?
There is something called a multiple support agreement. And oftentimes, especially in an aging parent situation, if the parent doesn't have enough to financially support themselves, collectively the family might decide to support the parent. And that through this multiple support agreement, one of the people who are claiming or who are helping to support that parent may be able to take that parent as a deduction, a dependent on their tax return.
Okay, great. Well, thank you again for all of your help this tax season, Mary. Hopefully we'll hear back from you again in the fall, and good luck with all your tax preparation. Mary Melman is a tax professional who's been in the tax business for more than 30 years. I want to say thank you to Lexi Broat for on-air production and to Michelle Good for technical direction. I'm Jill Nadeau, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening to the Ideas Network. Stay with us. There's a lot more to come.